This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Jack Black, is best known for his roles in High Fidelity, School of Rock, Shallow Hal, Tropic Thunder, Nacho Libre, and the animated Kung Fu Panda films. He's also known for his satiric hard rock heavy metal band Tenacious D, a duo with Kyle Gass. They have a new CD coming out May 15th. Black stars in the new movie Bernie, which is directed by Richard Linklater, who also directed Black in School of Rock. Based on a true story, Black plays the new assistant funeral director in a small Texas town. He has a gift for soothing the deceased families and is especially good with older people who've lost a spouse, which is how he becomes very close to the widowed Marjorie Nugent, played by Shirley MacLaine. She's generous to Bernie and takes him everywhere with her, including trips around the world. But eventually, she starts treating him like a servant, demeaning him until he snaps and shoots her in the back. Terry spoke with Jack Black last week and began with a scene of Bernie being questioned by the sheriff and confessing to the crime.
How long have you been thinking about killing her, Bernie?
I never thought of me killing Mrs. Nugent. I guess I fantasized about her death, but I was never the one responsible for it. Didn't she always die accidentally, like in a car accident or falling down the escalator at the mall in Longview? I was always the one weeping by her open casket, comforting others, being comforted myself.
Why'd you want her dead, Bernie?
She had become so mean and possessive of me. I couldn't face being around her any longer, and then it just happened. I don't know. I shot her. I shot poor Mrs. Nugent 4 times with the armadillo gun.
Then what?
Well, then the Lord called her home. I know I'd done wrong and I must atone for my sins.
That's a scene from the new film Bernie. Jack Black, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
This is a really different kind of role for you. You play someone who seems to be very controlled and who loves people, and people really like him. Older people love him. And he does something shocking. He commits this murder. And in the scene that we just heard, like, you're very vulnerable. Does this feel like a different turn for you?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it was a good role for me because of the similarities to other roles in a way. What was crucial was that he was really likable and that, you know, you could believe that the whole town would be sort of in love with Bernie, because that was the case. And Rick Linklater, who I worked with on School of Rock, felt that I'd be a good choice because, you know, feels weird for me to say this, but I was very likable in School of Rock, and he felt that that quality was perfect for Bernie. And he was also a real musical guy, and I obviously have that in my repertoire. So, I'd never delved the depths of that kind of dark emotion before. That was the real challenge, but I felt like I was well-suited to the role in other ways.
You met the real Bernie Teeter in prison, where he's serving a life sentence for murder. Mm. And is awkward the right word when you're A, meeting the person you're about to play, and B, it's in a maximum security prison?
Yeah, it was awkward, to say the least. I mean, there's a certain amount of anxiety that comes when you're going to meet someone new, and that's magnified to the power of 10 when you're going to meet them in a maximum security prison. There's a certain amount of intimidation just going through the gates. Just meeting the guards. You're seeing the general population in the prison, and there's a lot of rough customers in there. There's a lot of face tattoos and serious-looking people. And even though you've got the security there, you don't feel entirely safe. But then I got a couple people who were fans, and that made me feel a little more at ease. A couple people fans of Nacho.
Nacho.
And then, I saw Bernie in the middle of the yard, and they had a place for us to go and have a little interview. They gave us 45 minutes to talk. the awkwardness quickly melted away of saying, "Hi, I'm the guy who's playing you. Is that all right with you? And can you tell me some things about your life that'll bring you as a character into focus for me?" The awkwardness is in the fact that they're in a vulnerable position. You want to kind of put them at ease, that you're not there to lambaste them or to tell their story unfairly. I can imagine if someone was telling my life story, I'd be freaked out about, you know, certain chapters.
There's a fair amount of music in the movie because when Bernie is a funeral director, you know, your character is singing hymns at funeral services. Your character also loves theater, and he's involved in local theater, starring in productions of Guys and Dolls and The Music Man. And you even sing the old Stephen Foster song, Beautiful Dreamer, at a senior citizen's pageant, kind of like a senior beauty pageant. And this is all pretty far away from the kind of heavy metal, hard rock music that you're famous for loving and that you do kind of real and satirical versions of with your band Tenacious D. So before we talk about Tenacious D, just let's hear a little bit of you singing Beautiful Dreamer in the film Bernie.
Beautiful dreamer, queen of my song, list while I woo thee with soft melody. Gone are the cares of life's busy throng. Beautiful dreamer, awake to my song. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. Beautiful dreamer, awake unto me.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Black, and he's starring in the new movie Bernie. So there's a new Tenacious D album about to be released.
Yes.
I'm
going
to ask you to describe the band Tenacious D.
Tenacious D is comedy folk rock, is what I would say. And the only reason I say folk is because we're two acoustic guitars. At our core, it's just me and Kyle on acoustic guitars and singing, you know, kind of like Simon and Garfunkel. But then we're most heavily influenced by heavy metal bands of the 80s. And we used to make fun of the devil because the devil's influence on 80s metal was so prevalent, and now it just seems so ridiculous and hilarious. But this new album is more about redemption. It's a comeback-themed album.
Which leads me into the title track, which I'd like to play, if it's okay with you.
Please.
Yeah, so this is Rise of the Phoenix, the title track, and it's the story of your band, Tenacious D, making its big comeback, and it's a tribute to, you know, a lot of heavy metal music of the 80s. Do you want to say anything else to introduce it?
No, I think it speaks for itself. Well, it's in reference to our last album, which was a soundtrack to our movie, The Pick of Destiny, and it didn't do well in the box office scores, and it didn't do well with the critics. And this is our triumphant comeback to say, you know, you can't kill us.
Okay, so here's Jack Black and his band Tenacious D.
When the pick of destiny was released, it was a bomb. And all the critics said that the D was done. The sun had set and the chapter had closed. But one thing no one thought about was the D would rise again, just like the phoenix will rise again. 'Cause the fiery heart of a champion cannot be quenched by a failure or an embarrassment, no way, no. And the critics all agreed it was a stinky pile of cheese, but that does not mean that our hearts are not strong. Just like the phoenix, we'll rise again. Yeah. That's like the phoenix, we'll rise again.
That's Jack Black's band, Tenacious D, and
yes.
their forthcoming album, Rise of the Phoenix. What are some of your favorite things about heavy metal voices and the things that they, you know, like they're really like big dramatic flourishes?
Well, in general, in the vocals department, what I appreciate is glory. I was thinking about this the other day. And it's not just heavy metal, but, you know, hard rock in general. I like to include my brothers from The Who and Led Zeppelin. But if they can take me on a journey through the clouds, I don't have any real spirituality in my life. I'm kind of an atheist. But when music can take me to the highest heights, it's almost like a spiritual feeling. It fills that void for me.
But what about like certain just like vocal flourishes, like the excuse me for embarrassing myself here, like the ri-yi-yi-yi's again thing?
Oh, that.
Yes.
That was just me showing off. I wanted to show that I've got the chops, and I wanted to take my voice on a roller coaster ride. Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, that's just flexing in the mirror, vocal flex.
So is that one of the things you love about like hard rock? Is that the, you know, the bigness of it?
I do love the bigness, and it feels almost primal. It feels like we're Native Americans around the fire. Before there was big buildings and cars and civilization, there was just the power of a voice singing to the heavens.
So I can't help be reminded of your movie School of Rock, in which you play a musician who's kicked out of his own rock band because he's so mm-hmm. annoying. And and then you end up being a substitute teacher, and you want your students to like love rock. So you're teaching them all about rock, and you want them to form a rock band that you will lead. And trying to give them like an education about rock. So let's hear a clip of that scene.
All right. Now is everyone nice and pissed off?
Yeah.
Good. Time to write a rock song. Now what makes you mad more than anything in the world? Billy.
You.
Billy, we've already told me off. Let's move on.
You're tacky and I hate you.
Okay, you see me after class. You, Gordon.
No allowance.
I didn't get no allowance today, so now I'm really ticked off. You know what I mean? What else makes you mad, Michelle?
Chores.
I had to do my chores today, so I am really ticked off. What else?
Bullies.
All you bullies get out of my way, because I am really ticked off. So what would you say to a bully, Zach?
I don't know.
No, come on. If someone was right up in your grill, what would you say?
I don't know.
If someone was pushing you around, telling you what to do, what would you say?
Step off.
Step out! Step out! Step out! Step out! Everybody! Step out! Step out!
That's great. That's Jack Black in School of Rock. I love your heavy metal falsetto. That's such a key part of those bands.
I look forward to someday my Vegas show where I do excerpts of all the highlights of my career. I will definitely do a step off. I can see it.
Mike White actually wrote School of Rock for you. At least that's my understanding of it. And
it's true.
He told GQ in January 2006 that the reason why he wrote School of Rock was that he really liked you personally. And he said, I really believed in him as an actor, but all the scripts that were being sent to him were very much like the fratty guy who gets drunk and falls down. I think originally they were trying to put him in a John Belushi or even Chris Farley kind of little bit tubby, very sophomoric comedy thing. And in my opinion, there's such a bigger charm to him. So that's what Mike White, the writer of School of Rock, had to say. Do you think when you're a comic actor and you're also like a little heavy that you get typed into certain stereotype roles?
I don't think that that's necessarily a real problem. The real problem is, the real challenge is if you don't look super sexy, like a Brad Pitt, you're going to have to try harder. That's all. You've got to make up for it in other ways. You're going to have to charm the pants off of them. You're going to have to make them laugh. You're going to have to find some other. But those are good hoops to have to jump through. You're going to have to do some writing. Let's face it. The great comedians now that are handicapped in the looks department are tremendous writers. I'm not going to say who they are because now they'll be offended. But you know who you are if you're listening, and you know that I'm right. That's why it's what I tell anyone who approaches me that wants a career like mine. I say, well, then you better get to the writing, because I didn't really have anything going until I started, you know, writing songs and sketches for Tenacious D. And it's not enough just to be an actor anymore. You have to bring a whole skill set.
Now, you know how in the scene of School of Rock that we just heard, you were telling the kids to basically channel their anger and frustration and turn it into music. Did you do that when you were a teenager, you know, like try to channel your anger and frustration into music?
I did use music as an outlet, and I did like to sing and make music into my four-track. I had a four-track recorder in like 10th grade. I got my first one, my Tascam Portafive. Anybody out there that remembers those machines? And I loved just to sing as hard and as loud as I could. And in harmony, it was like a release. It was kind of like a form of therapy. It's like scream therapy, but I don't know. But I did have a lot of fiery temper.
Was the temper one of the reasons why you ended up going to? I've read that it was a school for problem kids, so you can tell me that that's wrong. Was it?
No, yeah, it was. It was a school called Poseidon for troubled youths. It wasn't my rage that got me there. That I had been, you know, experimenting with different drugs, and I was actually doing Coca-Cola. I was doing cocaine and running with a rough crowd. And I actually started to feel like I was in danger of getting badly hurt. There's some rough customers coming to exact some revenge on me for making out with the wrong girl. And then I actually asked my parents if they would take me out of the school, because there was a dude named Brock who's in a motorcycle gang that wanted to kick my ass, and I didn't want to face it. And my parents obliged. They knew that I was in trouble anyway, and they took the opportunity to send me to this little school for troubled youths. It was not a military school, but I guess it was a similar sort of alternative to regular public school.
Did part of you feel like you were supposed to, like, stand up to this guy and, like, fight him and, like, show him that you were no coward?
Well, I did kind of stand up to him in that, well, no, I didn't stand up to him, but he did kick my ass. And it was mostly just me rolled up in a ball while he punched and kicked me.
That's so horrible.
And then I knew he hadn't had his fill. He was cut off before he had really delivered his full punishment. So I exited, stage left.
What about acting in high school?
Yeah, I was real involved in the theater program in high school. And I was in a lot of musical theater. And that's, I guess, where my music and my acting started to mix.
Did you feel like, oh, how can I sing musicals when what I really want is hard rock?
No, I liked the musical theater. I didn't have any hang-ups at the time. I liked doing Pippin. We did Pippin, and one of my heroes when I was really young was Ben Vereen. When I saw him in a production of Pippin on cable TV, I was like, wow, look at his moves and his voice, and he was just a very charismatic and magnetic performer.
So what was your favorite role that you played in a musical?
Well, it's got to be Pippin. That was my best one. But we also did a production of a Bertolt Brecht play called The Caucasian Chalk Circle, and I played Azdak, the kind of anarchistic judge in a land that was sort of in turmoil. And that was kind of a heavy play to do in high school. It was pretty advanced. But I had a blast, and I overcame a lot of fears. I remember I was so scared opening night when we were supposed to do our first performance for all the parents, that I just called my teacher and said, I'm not doing the play. And he said, just come meet me at the diner. And so I met him at the diner that day. And he talked me into it, said, don't worry about failing. It's going to be fine. You know, it is what it is. It's an experience. You're going to learn from it. I was like, okay. And I did it. And I was so filled with fear and adrenaline that I gave probably my best performance of my life that day. And it's a lesson that I've carried with me, that just because I'm terrified doesn't mean that I shouldn't do it, you know. And a lot of times I'll want to turn down a role or something because I'm scared of what it is. Or that I won't do it well, that people will judge me, and then I have to say, nah, remember, high school, you were scared of Azdak. And I'll more often than not do it if I think that the fear is based in just cowardice as opposed to something that I really shouldn't do.
My guest is Jack Black, and he's starring in the new movie, Bernie. Your breakout role was High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
And High Fidelity, based on the novel by Nick Hornby, is set in a record store. You're one of the guys who works in the store, and you judge everybody, customers, your fellow workers, based on their taste in music.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get the role?
Well, John Cusack was a friend from the Actors Gang Theater Company, because he and Tim Robbins were tight buddies.
This is the theater company that you first worked in when...
That's right.
When you're getting started,
out of college. Actually, as far back as my senior year in high school, I was aware of them, and I would go to see their shows, and I idolized Tim and John. So John had seen my work at the Actors Gang, and then he saw me do Tenacious D, and he said, I want him to play Barry in High Fidelity. And I wrestled with it for a while. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it.
Why?
You know, because I was afraid. I was afraid people were going to judge me. But yes, but I was coming up with other reasons. I was like, yeah, man, no, I'm not going to talk about music like that. That's not cool. You don't just talk about Kurt Cobain. And, you know, there was a few lines in the script that ruffled my feathers, because, you know, there were certain things that you just don't name. You don't say those words out loud. They're too cool to be spoken out loud. But then once I got over the fact that it wasn't really the lines in the script, but the fact that I was going to be on a bigger stage than usual and that I would be judged, I realized that I had to face my demons and go into the battle. And I had that same kind of fear, adrenaline going like I did in high school in my first play, and I just acted my butt off. It was a transforming experience.
So do you judge people like the character in High Fidelity based on their music taste?
No, I don't. I can't judge because I've had so many hot, cheesy, corny loves of music in my life. I had a very intense Billy Joel period.
No.
So once you've really Joeled it up, and, you know, there's some good periods of Joel. It's not all hot cheese. But but I can't judge anyone else for their cheese. Are you kidding me? I've deep-sea dived in the Gouda.
Jack Black, it's really been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Pleasure was mine.
Jack Black speaking with Terry Gross. Black stars in the new movie Bernie, which has just opened in theaters. Tenacious D, his satiric music duo with Kyle Gass, has a new album coming out May 15th. The Ukrainian writer Andrei Kurkov has written 13 novels that have gotten him compared to everyone from Franz Kafka to John le Carré. His books were first translated into English in 2001 in Great Britain, where he soon developed a devoted following. But he still remained largely unknown in the United States. That began to change when Melville House started releasing his work last summer. Our critic at large, John Powers, is a fan and says Kurkov is the kind of writer you can get hooked on.
When you hear the words Russian novel, you probably picture something big and heavy as an anvil. Yet ever since the fall of communism, we've seen the ascent of Russian novelists who are shorter-winded and jauntier. The most sheerly enjoyable is Andrei Kurkov, who lives and works in the former Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Kirchhoff writes short, sly page-turners that specialize in what we might call absurdist noir. He's already a cult writer in the UK and Europe. Now, some of his best novels are being released by Melville House, one of those admirable small presses that, in our supposedly globalized age, are helping keep foreign literature from completely dying out in the U.S. Their most recent Kirchhoff release is The Case of the General's Thumb, a sardonically amusing romp that's well worth reading. Yet the book I suggest you start with, and that may get you hooked, is the 1996 novel that's probably Kirchhoff's best. It certainly has his best title, Death and the Penguin. Set in the run-amok city of Kiev, it's the story of Victor, a wannabe novelist who lives with his pet, a penguin named Misha, which he began looking after when the local zoo could no longer afford to keep him. To keep himself going, and Misha in frozen fish, Victor takes a job preparing advance obituaries for a local paper. Sounds promising, until Victor's obits turn out to be a kind of hit list. The people he writes about wind up getting murdered. And that's not all. Soon he's looking after the daughter of his dodgy human friend, Misha, called Misha Non-Penguin, whose shenanigans get Victor ever more deeply involved with the gangsters who run modern Ukraine. These thugs have their own strange use for Victor's penguin. Now, if you're like me, you may be skeptical of any book about a man with a pet penguin. It sounds too cute by half, like one of those movies where a loner hitman proves his humanity by raising a bonsai or talking to his pet cockatoo. Yet Misha the Penguin isn't a gimmick. Not only is he central to the plot, he's a mirror of Victor's own melancholy soul. Just as Misha is cut off from a sane environment for a penguin, he's been uprooted from both Antarctica and the zoo. So Victor is trying to survive in a city that's become hostile to simply being human. I don't know Russian, but in George Bird's wonderfully readable translation, Death and the Penguin comes across as an almost perfect little novel. Kirchhoff tells his story in a brisk, surreal deadpan that captures the mental atmosphere of a country that, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has often verged on black comedy. Indeed, since Kirchhoff wrote this book, Ukraine has been through at least one rigged election, had a presidential candidate poisoned with dioxin, staged an orange revolution, voted in a woman prime minister who lost another disputed election to the guy the orange revolution originally threw out, who then tossed her into prison for crimes that other nations don't remotely believe she committed. Meanwhile, the mafia operates with impunity and public services collapse. Remember how Victor got his penguin? That was true. Ukrainian zoos actually did give away their animals. Of course, what's bad for living can be good for literature. In conjuring the bedlam of Ukrainian life, Kirchhoff's novels are spiderwebbed with entertaining tricks and double crosses. In the new one, an honest cop goes on a wild goose chase to find the thumb of a murdered general. In another, a desolate husband takes out a contract on himself, then changes his mind, a bit too late. Spinning these yarns, Kirchhoff reveals a level of casual corruption so profound that ordinary people, just trying to get by, can't avoid being sucked into the muck. But please don't think Kirchhoff's work grim. It's not. It's fast-paced and witty and on the side of the angels. For all the immorality that threatens to drown them, his heroes cling, like latter-day Buster Keatons, to the life raft of their personal decency. They may not be able to change the world around them. The forces that run it are too big and too strong. But they can find odd moments of zen-like calm. And more important, perform the small kindnesses that reaffirm their humanity. Like looking after a penguin that wants nothing more than to find its way back home.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, Hugh Laurie talks about playing house on television. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. After 8 seasons, the medical mystery series House will conclude on May 21st. Our next guest, Hugh Laurie, is the star of the show and is directing next week's episode. Terry spoke with him last week. Laurie is a British actor who first became known to Americans for his work in the British comedy series Blackadder and Jeeves and Wooster. As Dr. Gregory House, Laurie plays a brilliant diagnostician who consults on the most mysterious cases at a teaching hospital in Princeton, New Jersey. The doctors and patients pay a big price for his genius. He's abrasive and condescending. His own medical problem is unsolvable. He's in constant leg pain and walks with a cane. It's led to a serious problem with a dependency on Vicodin. At the heart of each episode of House is a patient stricken with a mysterious life-threatening problem, which is misdiagnosed until House figures out the real cause. Some of the cases are comic, like the one in this scene from the 2004 series premiere, in which House was sent to diagnose a man at the hospital clinic who had turned orange. The patient speaks first.
I was playing golf and my cleats got stuck. I mean, it hurt a little, but I kept playing. The next morning, I could barely stand up. Well, you're smiling, so I take it that means this isn't serious. What's that? What are you doing?
Painkillers.
Oh, for your leg.
No, because they're yummy. You want one? Make your back feel better. Unfortunately, you have a deeper problem. Your wife is having an affair.
What?
You're orange, you moron. It's one thing for you not to notice, but if your wife hasn't picked up on the fact that her husband has changed colors, she's just not paying attention. By the way, do you consume just a ridiculous amount of carrots and megadose vitamins? Carrots turn you yellow, then niacin turns you red. Find some finger paint and do the math. And get a good lawyer.
Hugh Laurie, welcome to Fresh Air. So it's going to be weird. I'm sure everybody tells you this in America. It's going to be weird hearing you in your own voice because I'm so used to you as House with the American accent. The first time I heard you in your own voice, I couldn't believe it.
Well, thank you. I suppose that's a good thing. But yes, I am I'm not playing House today, so I am dressed as an Englishman, speaking as an Englishman. I'm wearing a bowler hat, if anyone's interested, and carrying a furled umbrella.
So if you wanted to do this interview in American, and I'm not suggesting that you do that, could you do that? Do you know American well enough to just improvise your way through it?
Yes, I think I do, but I have to have all sorts of emergency backup plans. If I see a word coming along that I know I can't do well, I have to find an alternative very, very quickly. I read the other day that people who stutter and stammer have to have the same mechanism where they see a problematic word hoving into view and they have to line up three or four alternatives to go to if it doesn't come out right the first time. And I have to do the same thing if I'm just sort of ad-libbing.
Are there certain words that you know will trip you up in American?
Yes. Can't say New York, so I don't go there.
Because I would say it New York with an N-O-O as opposed to an N-Y-O-O.
Yes. I don't know if it's the New or the York or the two of them together. I don't know what it is, but it just scares me silly. So I can't say it and I don't go there. Murder I can't say and I don't do it. I tend to avoid murder. I suppose it's R's. R's are the problematic letters. But I do find that I can't think of a single word or even a syllable that really comes out the same in English and American.
So House is ending at the end of this season. Why is it ending, and did you have a vote in that?
Yes, I did have a vote, although it never really came to that, you know, the paper, scissors, stone moment. It was a sort of a consensus that we had run our course, and it occurred to me the other day that I suppose one of the problems is that the character is so inherently self-destructive to the point of being virtually suicidal. A person cannot be a character, a fictional character cannot sustain that suicidal tension indefinitely. You can't have a man on a window ledge threatening to jump forever. At some point, he's either got to jump or get back into the building because the crowd below eventually will lose interest. And I think because the tension must dissipate eventually. And in actual fact, at the point we're going to leave the show, it's a Hamlet moment. It's a to be or not to be. It's House deciding whether to embrace life or death. But having made that decision, and I won't tell you what that decision is, I think it's time for us to move on.
So you've spent the better part of the past 8 years playing someone in constant physical pain. What impact has it had on your spine and your leg to walk with a limp so much?
I am horribly, horribly damaged, and let that be my opening statement in a massive lawsuit, which I am plotting. But my sport of choice when I was a young man was rowing, or crew, as I think you call it over here. And I always I rowed with the oar on one side, on strokes the stroke side, which meant my body was twisting in the same direction many, many thousands of times a day for about 15 years. And I think that's given me a permanent sort of kink anyway. So that might actually, I shouldn't be saying this because that's rather weakened my lawsuit now. I do remember, though, the first time I had an acting engagement outside of house. It was a film called Street Kings, and the first scene I did, oddly enough, was set in a hospital, and the director called action, and I started limping. And I think that's a bigger problem for me now, is that I just have a Pavlovian response to cameras. If I see a camera or if someone says action, I will start limping. I don't think I'll be able to walk straight now.
I just hope you have a good chiropractor to undo favoring one leg.
Yes,
or so.
They've got their work cut out for them, I think.
What's the worst physical pain you ever experienced?
When I was about, I think, 10 years old, I made a petrol bomb. Well, I thought of it then. A friend, there were two of us, and we thought of it at the time as a Molotov cocktail. That sounded so exotic and exciting. And it went wrong, and I got burning petrol on myself and burnt my leg quite badly. And my father, who was a doctor, and he treated me. It was just one of those rare times. He was massively unsympathetic, because I think he was so furious at the idea that I'd been playing with burning petrol. And it's a fair point. And I can remember sort of yelling at the top of my voice, "It hurts, it hurts." And he said, "Yes, it will." And that was a lesson learned. I think that was the most extreme pain I've been. Burns are, well, as is commonly known, burns are can generate quite extraordinary degrees of pain. And that was the worst that I can remember. Then there are the other kinds of pain, I suppose. The pain of rowing, I think, which is something you deliberately submit to. You try and load upon yourself, because the more you can endure, the further ahead of your opponent you'll get. That's probably, or that would probably come second in my litany of pain.
Did being a rower help teach you how to put pain aside and just focus on what you wanted to do?
I don't know. Maybe it did, or maybe I already had that sort of slightly masochistic cast of mind, and therefore that suited me to the sport, because I can remember at school I used to sit in class and just to while away an idle hour, I would induce cramp in my... I still, to this day, can do it. I could induce cramp in my feet and legs just to see how long I could stand it. I don't know why. That's rather odd, isn't it?
It is really odd. Cramps in feet and legs are so uncomfortable.
Yes. Well, I can and do induce it.
You still do that?
I do.
Wow, that's really weird, if you don't mind my saying.
I know, it is a bit weird. Yes, it is. And sometimes, if there's a bucket of ice about, and occasionally in life there is, one of the measures of pain, I think it's actually now a clinical measure of pain, is how long you can endure having your arm in a bucket of ice. And if I see a bucket of ice, I'm quite tempted to give it a go and see if I can put a stopwatch on it.
Because House is in constant pain, he's had really bad problems with Vicodin addiction. Did you do research on Vicodin and the long-term effects it would have?
I did research into the short-term effects, which were very pleasurable. And by the way, this was not within the borders of the United States. I'm just making that perfectly plain, but I took it for recreational purposes. Well, that's to say I was not in pain when I took it, so that counts, I suppose, as recreational. And the effects on the body are quite different if you're not actually suffering pain, so I understand. It's just a sort of pleasant, wafty feeling, extremely pleasant, and I can imagine highly addictive, but it's quite different, I think, if you're suffering extreme pain, you take it for analgesic reasons. And, of course, its long-term effects, I obviously couldn't research that without doing serious damage to my internal organs. So,
there's always the internet.
although I love my craft, I don't love it that much. There is, yes, and there are many stories to be told. But it is obviously a very, very serious problem in his life and many people's lives. I mean, it is alarmingly easy for people to stumble into a dependence on painkillers. You know, from the most trivial surgical procedures, somebody might take a couple of pills and then their life is never the same again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hugh Laurie, the star of House, and next week he directs the episode. So what was your audition like when you were auditioning to play House?
Well, it's one of the very rare times I've actually got a role from auditioning. I'm not a good auditioner, but this was a role I knew, even though I only had a couple of scenes, I felt that there was something in this, something very substantial in this, and I wanted to do it well. And I worked very hard at it. And I came to Los Angeles and I booked into a hotel room and I paced up and down in that hotel room for a couple of days just doing these two scenes over and over and over and over and adjusting. Because I was determined that this was not going to be one of those auditions where I walked out and smacked my forehead and said, oh, damn it, why did I do it like that? I wanted to do what I wanted to do and at least leave and say, well, that's how I think it should be, and if they don't like that, then that's their business. But I, at least I did what I wanted to do. So I tried to buy a cane. You can't, of course, buy a cane in Los Angeles because there are intimations of mortality there. And canes. Oddly enough, you can buy an umbrella, which you would think would be even less appropriate in Los Angeles, but that I did buy. I bought an umbrella and used it as a cane. And I hobbled up and down in my hotel room for days and days until I knew that no matter how scared I was, I couldn't be beaten out of doing it the way I wanted to do it. I rehearsed myself into the ground, as it were.
So, you know, I've been listening to your voice. We started off talking about how surprising it was the first time I heard you with your own British voice. We're so used to hearing you on House with an American accent. But, you know, as you've spoken, one of the things I've noticed about your voice is that I think it's like it's higher than House's voice, and House's voice tends to get more trapped in his throat than your voice. Can you talk about working up the voice for House?
As a consequence of my attempt to relax, I found that the only way that I could convincingly inhabit what the great trap for non-American actors trying to play Americans, I think, is to start thinking of Americanness as a characteristic. It isn't. It is no more a character trait than height. It is just a physical fact, and that's all there is to it. It says nothing about the psychology of a character. And you therefore have to not let it overpower the character and walk around. You know, I'm going to walk around in an American way. That's obviously absurd. So My most deliberate and conscious effort was to relax and not push the accent. And the consequence of that was that I think it went down in pitch. Not because I wanted it to go down in pitch, but I think when I stopped pushing at the accent, it just sort of came out that way. And pretty soon I was sort of stuck with it. It varies a bit depending on the tone of the, you know, as the show varies a lot, I think. One of the things I've always loved about House is that it skips through tones very quickly. And, you know, one's voice has to follow that to a degree.
So, you know, with House, the way you do House's voice, it's as if a lot of his dialogue was muttered under his breath or said between clenched teeth, you know, said as an aside, even when it's not really an aside, but sometimes it is an aside. It's just a very sarcastic aside that everybody hears because he's saying it
right.
Loud enough for everybody. But so is that intentional on your part? And can you talk about, like, placing your voice and maybe demonstrate that a little bit?
Well, I suppose when I'm really relaxing and not trying to, actually, really is one of the words is one of my sort of warm up American words, because it has an R and L's, and R and L's are the those are the twin demons for anyone trying to do an American accent. And yes, when I start to do that, the only way I can do it is to just completely let my throat go floppy and sort of wind up down here. I don't know why. But I suppose... But it somehow seemed appropriate for House. I felt it was right. I felt that he had a sort of confidence, a physical confidence and a physical command that would mean that he never needed to be shrill in any way. I was actually thinking the other day that in 8 years and 180 shows that we've done, I can only think of about four occasions when House actually deliberately raised his voice, which is unusual. I mean, that's unusual in life for someone to live that long without shouting at somebody. Although I'm not a shouter in life, I don't think, but I think it was important that House didn't have a... There was nothing shrill about him. He has a sort of physical confidence and a physical... He occupies a physical space in a very firm and confident way.
So I have to ask you, earlier you were telling me, when we were talking about pain and House's pain and pain that you experienced, you said that you used to and still sometimes do induce leg and foot cramps. And I'm just sitting here thinking, is he pulling my leg about that? Like, does he really do that, or is that a joke?
No, I'm really not. I could do it for you now.
It wouldn't make
excellent radio, I don't think. But unless I start pounding the desk in agony, then you might get a sense of it. But no, I genuinely can do that at a moment's notice, and I do. I really do. The strange thing is you can't repeat it. If you induce cramp in your foot or calf, you then have to leave it. You can't sort of do it over and over again. For some reason, there must be some strange physiological reason for that. So I only get sort of four bites at the cherry in a day, but I quite often take them. And I just sort of ride it out, and it's a few minutes, and it's rather... I know this is making me sound so weird, isn't it?
It's weird. What can I say? It's weird.
It is, isn't it? Yes. Yes. maybe I should have said that I am actually pulling your leg. I'm not, though. No, this is the truth. This is the truth. I can't explain it. It's just one of them things.
Hugh Laurie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you very much.
Hugh Laurie, star of the Fox series House, speaking with Terry Gross. The series finale will air May 21st. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.